and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The day today is January 19th, 2024, and this is episode 421. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, out here in very snowy and really darn cold western New York. Though not as bad as Buffalo. I guess it's our new tagline here in Rochester. Not as bad as Buffalo. They got like 4 feet of snow. So poor Eileen Jones, friend of the show out in Buffalo. Yeah. And they keep getting, and they're only like an hour away from here, and they get hammered with snow, and we don't seem to get much, at least in this latest iteration of climate change.
Anyway, well, Eileen has two dogs, and dogs are an ice age design. They usually like snow, although these are short-haired, skinny dogs, so I don't know.
My Siberian Genghis, who sadly is dying of cancer now, but he's always loved snow because he's got even those big tufts between his paw, toes on his paws. And the Siberians have three layers. It's really cool, and they shed seasonally to deal with the warm weather. And so he doesn't like the summers much. That's how I was when I was younger, and he loves the winters.
Yeah, that's how I was when I was younger, but not anymore.
I know. I'm more like the short-haired dog now.
Yeah.
As you can hear, I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. the War Nerd, a.k.a. Gary Breccia. And so, John, how you doing out there?
Keeping I'm warm? Good. It's much warmer now. It was freezing a while ago, and we discovered why our beach house is a beach house, because it's meant for very hot weather, and in any other weather, it turns into a kind of shack. But it's just mildly wintry. In fact, last night, because we were setting up a show that didn't come off, actually. I was at a monastery that turned out to be a sort of subterranean cell. Like, the ceilings were just high enough for me not to bonk my head, and I'm not that tall. But the good part is, when they added heat, which the monks probably didn't have, it got very warm. Mm. And I liked it. I'm not sure Catherine liked it, but I had to override her veto. I was like, no, we're being warm tonight.
For some reason, I get really hot at nights, though. And some people get that way. And actually, for like a, what was it, either a birthday present or a Hanukkah present or something, my wife got me this really cool like blanket that gets cold and keeps it kind of, not cold, cool, I should say. And it's just, I'm sure I'm going to get cancer from it, but it does keep me cool, so at least I'll sleep for a while. Right, so, a lot of war stuff has happened. And it just gets, Biden just killing it out there. literally.
I love that quote. That was like, one of the most annoying rhetorical techniques of this era is the self Q&A. it's such self-important nonsense. Did I kill my roommate? Yes. Am I sorry? I truly am. It's always like that, always self-serving and ridiculous.
But it's right up there with people who refer to themselves in the third person. Bob Dole doesn't approve of that. Bob Dole says, it's very self-important. So this quote by Biden, the reporter says, sir, are the airstrikes against the Houthis working? And Biden says, well, when you say working, are they stopping the Houthis? No. Are they going to continue? Yes. I mean, what's the rhetorical trope for that? Because I don't know if there is. Senility?
Senility. Because, it's an interrogatio of some kind, but that's just saying it's a question thing. But it's more of a non sequitur.
Yes, exactly. The non sequitur. It's like,
I'm not even sure that's a rhetorical trope. It's just something that dumb people do. And it's like, that would not normally track as a self-aggrandizing answer of any kind. It's just, are they working? No. I mean, more than anything, it reminds me of one of the most beautiful folk rhymes I've ever seen. It was a poem in a newspaper of the Prohibition era, and I'll see if I can remember it right now. Prohibition is an awful flop. We like it. It can't stop what it's meant to stop. We love it. It can't prohibit worth a dime. It's filled the land with vice and crime. It's left a trail of something grime. Nevertheless, we love it. And that the point of that was the non sequitur, but
right.
You were meant to laugh at that.
Yes.
And in Biden's case, somehow he doesn't think you're meant to laugh at it. I suppose he's endlessly pursuing presidentialness, which is seen as like banging your head against a brick wall hard enough, sufficiently often to be a tough guy.
Yeah, it is very strange, though, admitting that they're not doing anything, but they're going to continue. I mean, it pretty much sums up a lot of Biden, policy, and a lot of just basically all foreign policy for quite a long time. A lot of dumb policy, but it's also sort of like, it's kind of the opposite. More like, okay, smart guy, you think you have some power over me by, pointing out that it's not working? Well, let me tell you, I'm going to continue it even though it's not working, even though I know it's not working. I'm the one in power here. Fuck you.
And that was the tone of all foreign policy news since the Israeli invasion of Gaza.
Yeah.
It was like, we're in override mode now, and we're not taking any employee suggestions. we're doing this because this is why we got here. This is a very deep, old agenda by, I don't know, hundreds of Democratic administrations in the past. And mainly it's that thing that you've mentioned before, that we got here above all so that we could play games with the world situation.
Mm-hmm.
We might have to throw a sop once in a while to grumbly peasants within the U.S. But what we really are here to do mm-hmm. is play around with the world in Ukraine, in Gaza, and anywhere else that strikes our fancy. As you've said many times, that's what really excites these people, really makes them feel presidential. And I think the euphoria that comes with doing that absolutely overrides any pain reflex that might be caused by local reaction.
Yeah. And we are genuinely powerless, or largely powerless, because what is Trump supposed to be the anti-war candidate? I mean, he might be maybe slightly less pro-war. I don't know if that's even true than Biden. I mean, I think you could say about Trump that the Syrian war wound down rather than ramped up if Hillary mm-hmm. had won. But it was under Trump that, Yemen got worse and worse.
Yeah.
And he was feeding the Saudis, endless weaponry. He did try to pull out of Afghanistan, and he got blocked because he's so feckless, too busy tweeting. So Biden did that. I mean, I don't know. They oftentimes come in saying they're going to do things differently in foreign policy wise. They're not going to be the world policeman. They're not going to make all those mistakes that the predecessors made. And it never takes more than a year or two before they're back in the game.
No, but I think what you were saying is in this administration's case, something else was going on. Like, we are going to run the world properly
once we
get back in.
Right.
Because Trump is just a fool.
And right. He made us look bad.
We know what levers to press.
Yeah. And he made us look bad. He made our foreign policy class and the whole empire look bad. He questioned NATO. I mean, this was like sacrilege. It was like saying the word Jehovah, in the life of Brian. Like, you'd have to stone him for saying.
Yeah.
So it was all about restoring America's credibility, restoring deterrence, playing with the world. And I feel like they're dangerous people. I mean, you can pry their imperial games from their cold, dead hands if you want to. Like, they ain't giving it up. So all we can do is bitch about it, I guess, as much as we can. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that is about all we can do. But, you know, if it's any comfort, they don't have as much control over the world as they seem to think. In fact, they inevitably mess it up.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Biden is... It's wild. I mean, he is destroying his presidency. I mean, I'd like to say, for sort of poetic sake, he's destroying his presidency for Netanyahu, who despises him and wants the Democrats out of power.
And makes his scorn obvious. I mean,
shoves it in his face.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Biden apparently hasn't spoken to Netanyahu since for about a month now, since sometime early mid-December, because Biden finally started coming and saying, hey, Bibi, you know, I've done all these favors for you. Can you do this one thing for me? No. You know, Israel, do whatever it wants. I'm sorry. Yeah, and so that was it. But Netanyahu is making it public, too, just in case Biden's embarrassment wasn't bad enough privately. He went public yesterday and said, in the future, the state of Israel has to control from the river to the sea, the entire area from the river to the sea, from west of the Jordan River, which is, you know, not genocidal rhetoric when it's only genocidal rhetoric if some student on a college campus says that and Bill Ackman gets upset, but otherwise it's not genocidal rhetoric. But I mean, the point of that was to signal to really to Washington. I mean, no other ally matters. We are not going to listen to you, and you can't do jack about it. And
it's odd because they actually could.
Yes, they could. No, he's saying you won't do jack about it. I mean, I wonder almost if Netanyahu is kind of hoping, because Netanyahu is under so much. I mean, first of all, he's a bastard. He's a fascist pig, and he's racist and all these things. So he's already a, you know, far right winger. But the pressure domestically is for ethnic cleansing from within, is to stay in power. Mm. It's to keep the war going and to cleanse Gaza and eventually, you know, the West Bank. And the Israeli public, like, the last thing that I think the large majority want to hear is that there's going to be a Palestinian state. That they would look at that as defeat. Yeah. And so he needs Netanyahu. He needs the U.S. He needs Biden, if he even would consider it. And I doubt he would. But if he would, he would need the pressure to be public, loud, dangerous, in order to rattle the Israeli public into understanding why Netanyahu would have to change policy. And Biden is not forthcoming. It's just unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway. That said, real quickly, we want to, and then we're going to talk about Yemen in particular, just do some back history on Yemen and the Houthis. But real quickly, we should just mention, you know, how the war widened. I mean, first of all, in between last episode and this one, so far things are going pretty much according to how we assumed it would go, which is the missiles aren't doing anything to deter the Houthis. I mean, the U.S. airstrikes are doing nothing to deter the Houthis. I mean, I'll just read off a headline from Bloomberg yesterday. Airstrikes on Yemen bring new level of chaos to shipping in the southern Red Sea. Crews increasingly unwilling to navigate southern Red Sea. So, you know, the decision, the U.S. and U.K.'s decision to hit back at Houthi militants has only escalated the chaos across the shipping industry. And let's be honest, that's what we're intervening to protect container ships, you know, mostly, and to distract from, you know, the genocide, underscoring the threat of an enduring supply chain crisis as vessels navigate the crucial trade route. So I think we've launched now four waves at least against Houthis, and it hasn't done anything. Like, it hasn't stopped. Yeah. Everything's, the Houthis are still attacking ships, still making noise. And we could see, if we see like real supply chain issues again, you know, you could start seeing inflation going up soon, thanks to this.
The Houthi have been hit with everything in the U.S. arsenal. The Saudi Air Force has been their main high-tech opponent in the war. But the Saudi Air Force proved largely ineffective because the Houthi aren't really an armored force. They don't depend on big concentrations of troops. They're a hit-and-run outfit, and they're very good at that. They've always been very good at that. But as that failure became apparent, and the Saudi army was just failing outright, there are photos of out-of-shape Saudi troops just like trying to scramble away from their outposts before they're slaughtered. The Air Force became a punitive force, as very often happens, And they started accidentally or accidentally, not so accidentally, hitting school buses and marketplaces, especially markets, outdoor markets, which are big in Yemen. And they hit them all the time.
And double tapped them, you know?
Yes. Double tapped so that people would be trying to save some of the casualties and then would get killed themselves. And there was no, I don't know how to express this, but there was no way on earth that the Houthi were going to cave to that. It didn't enter their minds. They've been fighting for a long time against the Saud family and against the predecessors of the Saud family and the Najd, against the Turkish Empire. We'll get to this later, but there was nothing that was going to stop them. So the U.S. Air Force, which is a lot more circumscribed and, to be fair, a lot more accurate than the Saudi Air Force, is not going to do anything that would make an impact on the Houthi.
Yeah, I mean, their hope, I think, is that they could take out infrastructure to make it harder for them to fire, infrastructure for the missiles, like radar and, you know, maybe even the missile site launch sites themselves. And they probably hit some of them, but it's not like the Houthis haven't prepared for this. I mean, they launched a lot of missiles and drones at Saudi Arabia during that war, a lot. And the U.S. during that whole time was in the war room with the Saudis, providing intelligence, providing targeting, supposedly for humanitarian purposes, you know, trained, like everything was an American and UK operation, except the guy that actually flew the plane and pressed the button that unloaded, flew the American plane and unloaded the American bomb. So, yeah, the Houthis have some experience also protecting their missile weapons. And anyway, so that's going on. And then in the meantime, Iran, which got hit by supposedly an Islamic State in Khorasan, suicide bombers. I think it's pretty much well agreed that it was Islamic State. The question, the real question is who's behind them. I mean, it's interesting to note that at least during the 2010s period, during, you know, until recently, according to Antonio Giustozzi's book on Islamic State, Khorasan Province, it was Qatar that was a big backer, along with the Saudis, of ISIK. And that was aimed at Iran because of, well, for obvious reasons, you know, for what was going on in Syria, and it was a way of leverage against Iran, also against Russia. And interesting point on that is that the suicide bombers were apparently ethnic Tajiks. I mean, from Tajikistan, not even ethnic Tajiks, but Tajiks from Tajikistan, which kind of, you know, that's one of the few places in the world that Russia still has bases, foreign bases. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. So Iran decided to launch missiles and apparently maybe drone, but I think mostly missile attacks. This is very unusual for Iran, very unusual for any country except really the U.S. and Israel. It struck at what it called terrorist bases and a Mossad base, one in Erbil in the Kurdish autonomous region of Iraq. It struck in Syria and Idlib, and it struck, which really surprised people, at Pakistan. And just real quickly on these ones, in Erbil, they launched 11 ballistic missiles, targeted a prominent Kurdish businessman who supposedly had Mossad ties.
The Kurdish region, especially the Barzani people, got very, very close to Israel after some of their other allies sort of deserted them. This is the really sad story of Kurdish movements in general, especially the not very bright ones like the Barzani clan. The Suleimani Kurds are a little smarter, or at least it seems that way to me. But they hitched their star to Israel, and Israel can do some good for a movement like that. But in the long run, it's going to take care of its own interests, and just as the U.S. does. And Kurds have a long history of getting dropped. Yes. So
yeah, we've talked about that on many depressing episodes, especially during the Syrian war. Anyway, apparently they fired Fateh 110. That's the name of the missile, the ballistic missile. That's a short-range and older missile that's been constantly upgraded with a 500-kilogram warhead. For Syria, they fired four, they're called either Khaybar missiles or Khorramshahr 4, I believe is what they're called, which is a brand new missile. I mean, I think it just unveiled later last year, has a range of 2,000 kilometers and can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead. And that targeted Islamic State figures there. And then in Pakistan, a lot of the it's not so easy to find information there. I mean, apparently Iran said they used precision missile and drone strikes. They targeted Jaish al-Adli, Balochi, Sunni kind of Salafist group, sort of nationalist Salafist group. You can guess who backed them. They were very anti-Iranian. I think they've had a lot of skirmishes on the border with Iran. They've killed a lot of sort of border guards over the years since they launched in 2012. And then, but you know, this was Iran hitting a nuclear power, right? I mean, Pakistan has nukes. And so Pakistan was angry and responded with what they said were, they responded not by hitting Iran itself, but by hitting Balochi separatists holed up in Iran that are trying to help, because Balochistan crosses between Western Pakistan and into Eastern Iran. We did an episode with these long wars on the Balochistan insurgencies a while back. So you can listen to that.
So this offers Balochistan the chance to get bombarded by both sides in the struggle.
I was trying to find out what they hit each other with. So the Pakistan said they fired drones, rockets, and standoff weapons, meaning, I don't know, glide bombs or missiles fired from aircraft. There was a report out that said Iran used, I don't know if this is true, Chinese-built fighter jets, JF-17 and J-10C Vigorous Dragons, and that Pakistan used Chinese UAVs in its operation. I don't know. It's not quite as easy to get information on what actual weapons were used. And the reason I bring this up is just, look, the Iran hit, I mean, we're sort of, as Americans anyway, we're more used to the U.S., you know, when it feels it's been, the U.S. basically bombing wherever it wants in the world under the guise of fighting terrorism. So it doesn't even seem weird to us anymore. You know, and as Greg Grandin talked about with us, I mean, this was something very new, and this was one of Kissinger's big innovations with the bombing of Cambodia. And at that time, when we found out that the U.S. was bombing a country that had nothing even to do with, you know, the Vietnam War, except that supposedly North Vietnamese were using it to supply weapons to the Viet Cong. The establishment in the U.S., not even just the public, but like big establishment Cold War figures, were absolutely shocked and horrified that we would just covertly decide in the president's office to bomb a country.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's just SOP. And of course, Israel does it too. But it's straight now, Iran is doing that thing that was supposed to be only our purview.
Yeah, it was great when the war on terror era, that's very hard to do, era began, because it was easy to say we're hitting non-state actors and they could be anywhere, you know, they could be in the suburbs of Connecticut and, you know, suddenly there would be a big explosion in the suburbs of Connecticut. It's like, we can't discuss that. They were non-state actors, which is almost certainly true if it's the suburbs of Connecticut, but doesn't necessarily explain what's really going on. But you can get away with a lot doing that. And, you know, Iran probably knows fairly well in their defense who their enemies are. They argued that this Kurdish magnate who was killed in the attacks was part of a spy network. Maybe so. I don't know. They are employing the same strategy now. Like, state borders don't necessarily matter when it's a war on what we construe as terror. And what they construe as terror, obviously, is very different from what the State Department does.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously Iran is doing this in the midst of, Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza and the U.S. now getting directly involved, attacking one of Iran's main allies, the Houthi movement, the Houthi militants. And so Iran, rather than directly hitting at the U.S., is demonstrating its power, but using what is now normalized by the U.S., you know, a rationalization normalized by the U.S., which is hitting at terrorist bases. But it's obviously a demonstration at us and at Israel and at the world arms market. I mean, one thing, and then we'll get to Yemen, but, you know, Turkey's arms industry got a lot of gruesome good press from the Azerbaijan war on Nagorno-Karabakh and from the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine with the with its drones in particular. But you haven't heard much about the Turkish drones and weapons in the last year or so. But you have heard a lot more about the Shahid, you know, the Iranian drones, which have been very effective. And, you know, you have to say this. I mean, every military attack also has an eye towards the global, the very lucrative global arms market. And Iran, clearly, despite all the sanctions and everything, it's a very self-sufficient state. It's forced to, and it has a pretty impressive second-tier weapons industry.
Yeah, and then the Chinese drones, they've been coming on very strong, particularly the ones that have been supplied by the UAE to the Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. There's something called the Wing Lung 2, quite a big drone that can fire standoff weapons and did a lot to destroy the TPLF or TDF forces when they were postured to hold off Ethiopian offensives. And then when they went on the offensive, heading south toward Addis Ababa, these Chinese drones hovered over the Tigrayan advance and just picked off good targets until the advance just stalled out. It was just too dangerous to keep going on to the south. So, that's also going to be a big selling point. Like, look how well we did in Ethiopia.
Yep. So I think with that, we could now start talking about, about Yemen. And, I mean, one reason we wanted to get into Yemen was some I don't know, maybe they were newer subscribers, commenters seemed, or a few of them seemed to be bothered by the fact that we didn't consider, we weren't anti-Houthi enough, or we didn't frame the Houthis, we didn't take seriously enough this notion that's going around that the Houthis are just Iranian proxies,
yeah,
and whatever the hell that even means and why that makes people feel better about anything. They're definitely allies of Iran. They're not proxies. I'll say this straight up, yeah, right? I mean, I'll restate it again. And just because a lot of people haven't heard much or don't know much about the Houthis, well, it's a lot easier to kind of accept that received idea and the propaganda about them than say, you know, Hamas. I mean, there are people who want you to believe that Hamas are Iranian proxies.
Yeah.
But does anybody seriously believe that? I mean, I think the general view is Iran didn't even know that about Hamas's attack in advance.
Yeah.
And they say the same about Hezbollah. And anybody who's seriously studied Hezbollah knows it's not like Iran says jump and Hezbollah says how high. It's nothing like that at all. Yeah. Although they are allies and they work together and they share a lot of intelligence and interests, but they are not proxies. And so John wanted to go back because John has written, as I mentioned in the last episode, a lot. We've talked a lot about Yemen and the Houthis. John has written a lot about Yemen and the Houthis going back, you know, two decades now. And so, John, why don't you talk about this
again? Yeah, okay. The Houthi are a recent development. They're named after someone who was a martyr of the movement, the Houthi. It's a family name, basically. But the people they represent, the families they represent, go back a long, long way and have changed allies without changing their basic ideology for a very long time. I mean, they are Zaydi Shia, which was the kind of Shiism that was practiced by most people in Najran, where I lived about 15 years ago. And the Zaydi Shia attacked the Saudi regime when the local princeling who was put in charge of Najran said that they were heretics. It's instinctive. It's a kind of sectarian reflex that requires cohesion within the group and a threat from outside, and then it becomes a very effective military force. Part of that is geography. A lot of Shiism, especially Zaydi Shiism, goes back to the big break in the 7th century between the first caliph, when Ali was supposed to become a successor, the new caliph, but then Abu Bakr took power instead. And the people who survived Abu Bakr's reign were the ones who tended to live in areas that could be defended. And that was very much true of the Zaydi Shia. The Zaydi inhabited the area around Najran, which is right on the border of Yemen, and especially the Yemen highlands, which, believe me, rear up like a very scary wall just to the south of Najran. They had the mountains protected them, and they developed, like a lot of Highland peoples, in fact, some Highland peoples in the U.S. Civil War, for that matter, the Appalachians, but or the Ethiopians, the Habesha, the Christian Ethiopians against the Muslim regimes around them, they developed a defensive reflex and practiced their warfare against all comers. That's the main thing I want to stress here. Against all comers. It did not much matter who was opposing them. Their biggest threat after Abu Bakr himself was the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was foolishly tempted into invading Yemen. It did not go well. The Ottomans in the 16th century were a very quickly expanding power. They were the world power, the dominant power. And they looked around and saw that Yemen had this gate to a trade route that controlled the Indian Ocean and would make a profitable colony. They were expanding in all directions, really. So after the end of their war with the Egyptian Mamluk, they decided to go into Yemen. This is a very common thing. Like, you might not think so from the map, but Egypt and Yemen have a strong link for a lot of would-be conquerors. The trouble is, it went really badly. They couldn't capture, especially those highland cities in North Yemen, which are currently the center of Houthi resistance. The Sa'ada, Shahara, they failed in all those things. They tried again in the 1630s. Once again, the Zaidi Imam defeated the Ottoman imperial troops. And that is quite an accomplishment. You'll notice also that the imams were a kind of religious war leader. They didn't necessarily control the entire territory of the Zaidi, but they could unite everyone in this war to defend the highlands. Finally, in the 18th century, the Zaidi state fractured, and the Ottomans asked one of their vassals to try to conquer it, but the British Empire by that time was a rival, and they decided, no, we want some of Yemen. We want particularly Aden, which was an excellent port, an irreplaceable port on the Indian Ocean, because we're going to use it as a staging area for our Indian colony, which really made the money in the empire. But the Ottomans after that focused on some areas that are very familiar from the news today, especially Hudaydah. 1849, the Ottomans once again returned to Yemen and took Hudaydah. It's much easier to take the ports of the Zaidi area than it is to take the hills and the highlands. Usually, once you start marching into the hills, you lose. As one Turkish commander said, you know, we have found no better foundry for troops than Yemen. All our armies melt away once they go into those hills. So the Yemeni are now faced with two powers. They can sort of defeat the Ottomans, who are a fading power. They can't defeat the British, but they are lucky in a way that the British don't want the highlands of Yemen. The only thing that the highlands of Yemen have going for them traditionally is they are good cropland, at least compared to the lowlands of Yemen, which are just flat-out desert. But the British didn't care about that. They could supply Aden, their colony, by ship. So what they did, and this has a great impact on Yemen today, to dilute the Yemeni population, was to flood Aden with other peoples who were also subject to the British, and many of whom were roughly slaves to the British, people from various parts of India and the East Indies. So from there on, from about 1840 on, southern Yemen became a very, very different part of the country from northern Yemen, which remained at least once you went a couple of miles inland, very much Shia, warlike, traditional community. That's why Aden later became a center of socialist and other agitation, which was completely resisted by the Highlands. There were further revolts against the Ottoman Empire right up until it died. And classic example, 1891, the Northern Shia decided that the Ottoman Empire was not sufficiently religious because they were trying to do something a little more secular because they had their own elites to satisfy in cities like Istanbul or Constantinople.
Yeah. The Southern Balkans, right? It was like their heartland at that time, yeah.
Yeah, but that did not work. So another revolt in 1904, Ottoman casualties, more than 25,000. Finally, they staged a big offensive the year after that, and they reopened negotiations with the imam. Again, the imam was the religious and war chief of northern Yemen, not necessarily the everyday political chief. And they agreed to a face-saving treaty for northern Yemen to become a vassal state of the caliphate. Of course, the caliphate only lasted another decade because it foolishly entered, it was already overthrown by the time the successor state entered World War I on the German side. But what you see here is it doesn't matter that those people were Turkish or Ottoman or even Shia. What mattered was that they were trying to attack northern Yemen, which was one of those states, like parts of Lebanon were until very recently, a hilltop area that was willing to defend itself against all comers and didn't particularly care who they were. That's why this Iran thing is bizarre. There are constant players in Yemeni history, but they are the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, the Egyptians off and on, the British after 1840. But Iran is not a big player in Yemen. Iran may be useful now as an ally, but there just isn't that tight link between northern Yemen and Iran the way there is, as Mark, you said a few minutes ago, between parts of Lebanon and Iran, mm-hmm. or even Hamas and Iran, and especially parts of Iraq and Iran. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen in Yemen. They share roughly a Shia identity, but not even quite the same kind of Shiism. And I'll be honest that I don't understand much about Shia theology because it's in large part a dynastic argument, and dynastic arguments just lose me. Like, you know, I can never remember who Fatima, whose relative Fatima was. It just loses me. But I'm pretty sure that the Zaidi Shia are not the same variety of Shiism as the one that prevails in Iran. But the real question here is, like, why Iran? Why not Saudi Arabia? The real problem for Yemen in the last century plus has not been anything about Iran. It's the Saudis. There has been a lot of fighting and friction between Saudi Arabia as it coalesced and then got bigger and stronger and richer, and Yemen, especially northern Yemen. This has been really, really weird in a lot of ways. I actually had an encounter with a few Yemenis when I was in Najran. But the most amazing thing about Yemen was the absolute wall between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. There was almost no contact. And it literally looked like a wall. Yemen looked like a wall of stone to the south of Najran. There was one little gully that would go up to a dam, which had once contained the water from a dying river that began in Yemen. But once you went up there, you saw the dam did not contain any more water anymore. It was totally dry. And once I saw a party of Yemenis when I went to the dam, I didn't know who they were, but the guide, after seeing us looking at them, said, "Yemeni." And they were, the reason we were looking at them is they were totally unlike the Saudi people that we dealt with every day. They were, first of all, smaller and thinner, much thinner, and very, very alert. They were sitting on the grass near a little picnic area by this dry dam. The men were sitting outside the circle. The women were sitting inside the circle. Every single pair of eyes was watching us as we moved around. Totally different people. Very much unlike the Saudi attitude, like, you know, "You're all here to serve me. Go get me some groceries." Very, very different. And that's why it's bizarre to see Iran as the real factor in Yemen. The question has always been Yemen and Saudi Arabia. For a brief period, it was joined by a lot of other powers in the 1960s. I'll talk about that in a minute. But Iran has been sort of promoted to a boogeyman role in Yemen that it really doesn't deserve. It may be a supplier now, but that's a matter of convenience. The Yemenis will take aid from anybody they want. What they resent is the Saudi power, especially because, and there's no way to avoid this, they see the Saudis as kind of big bumpkins. I mean, Yemen used to be the cosmopolitan part right. of the peninsula. Yemen dealt with, traded with the whole world. There are, you know, Roman coins in Yemeni markets until recently. Whereas they saw these guys on camels in the Najd, the big desert in the north of Arabia, as bumpkins. And suddenly the bumpkins have a British and American alliance, originally against the Turks, who the Yemenis knew very well. And then they have all the money in the world and all the American weapons in the world. And they start using them against Yemen. When I was living in Najran, for example, Najran was part of Saudi Arabia, which is why I ended up getting sent there by my TESL company. But it had not originally been part of Saudi Arabia. It had been leased by the Saudi government soon after it got money from the first of its oil leases. And when the lease was up in the 1920s, and everybody in Najran, by the way, could tell you this story, and they all sided with the Yemeni. When the lease was up, and it was a one-year lease, the Saudis basically said, "What are you going to do? Take it? Mm-hmm. We'll call up the Americans. We'll call up the British." And so no one was able to take it. So if there is a Mr. Big in Yemen, and there is, it's Saudi Arabia. It's the American proxy in town, not the American enemy in town. And for that matter, Iran was an American proxy also until the Shah was overthrown. It's just that why would you hire Iran to do the empire's work in Yemen? You had Saudi Arabia, which has always done it. So what happened in the 1960s was a war, a civil war, between two factions in Yemen. Basically, the north, the same faction that is now the Houthis, and the south, that cosmopolitan area heavily influenced by immigration from the subcontinent and more cosmopolitan Arab areas, centered in Aden, which went, like most of the Arab world, left in the 1960s and started to advocate socialism, communism, whichever you prefer. In those days, that made the south of Yemen, Aden and the areas around it, the enemy of the West. And who was the friend of the West? The same guys who are now the enemy of the West, the Shia of northern Yemen, because they haven't changed. They haven't changed at all. If there's a problem with them, it's kind of that. They were intensely socially conservative and in some ways like child marriage that are kind of unattractive. I'm not trying to whitewash that particular culture. But they specialize in not changing. And the idea that they're under Iran's thumb, it's just bizarre once you know them. They have a way of life. They have a way of fighting. They have everything. And they're not going to change it for anybody. So in the 1960s, basically, it's a complicated story. Basically, Aden became a center of revolution in the Arab world. It had been a recent city made up of all these immigrant groups, and socialism as a progressive ideology started to filter into these groups. The communists became strong, and they got the backing of Nasser's people, who were not themselves communist. That was a big argument at the time. Anybody who was helping communists must be a communist, which was nonsense. But Nasser and Egypt decided to back them against the reactionary royalists in northern Yemen because, you know, they were kind of reactionary. They hadn't changed in a very, very long time. And Nasser and his people were, above all, partisans of change. Like, we got to get rid of all this backed-up crud in the Arab world, and we've got to break it open, have a new day. So they made an alliance with southern Yemen. They had the backing of the USSR, although the USSR was a weak friend to have in most of these cases. Iran simply didn't play any role in all of this. Iran was a U.S. ally at the time under the Shah, but it really wasn't necessary for Iran to be involved. The U.S. delegated that to Britain and the Saudi Empire. The war began in 1962 when the hereditary rulers of North Yemen were removed by these rebels from the south. And Kennedy was seen as being too soft on Nasser, who was seen as a communist, which was absolutely wrong. Israel said so. The right-wing media said so. The Daily Telegraph said that JFK wasn't jumping into Yemen fiercely enough. That should sound familiar. The Daily Telegraph said that JFK wasn't jumping in on the Saudi side strongly enough. Quote, "Nowhere have the blunders of President Kennedy's policymakers been worse exposed than in Yemen. Cairo, that is a metonymy for Nasser's Egypt, has become the communist backdoor into Arabia. The Yemeni Republic is a little Cuba on the Red Sea," which was utter nonsense. I doubt the Shia of northern Yemen knew or cared that there was a place called Cuba, or for that matter, that there was a place called the Soviet Union.
Well, but he's talking about southern Yemen there. No, I mean, weren't they Marxist at some point? Or?
Oh, yeah, they were Marxist, okay. But there was at least as strong a reactionary axis in Yemen as in the south. And in fact, what ended up happening was that an international coalition of mercenaries basically killed off all the socialists and communists of southern Yemen. There ain't no more of them.
Yeah.
And this is something that was repeated throughout the Muslim and the Arab world. They just all got slaughtered. But at this point, right-wing Arab regimes were joining up and joining the chorus of desire to exterminate these people. Quote, King Saud and King Hussein of Jordan, mindful of Nasser's previous threat to topple them both, along with the Yemeni imam, pledged men, money, and munitions, the three M's, to overthrow Salal, the Yemeni who was collaborating too closely with Nasser, as they saw it. Basically, what they were dealing with was a clique of modernist officers in the Yemeni army who, much like the Young Turks a century earlier, said, we want to modernize. We're sick of all this. There was no sense that you were dealing with a fractured country which had been invaded and repopulated by British colonizers when a northern part of it was absolutely ignored and left alone in its ancient culture. They, quote, distinctions between Sunni and Zaidi Shia were overlooked in the common hatred of Nasser, as one author wrote about this period.
I think Nasser for a while was in the U.S. magazine press equated with Hitler. He was another, there's a whole pantheon of bogeymen who are the new Hitlers. And I think there was a time when he actually was kind of respected briefly. Actually, the CIA even thought he could be our guy. And then when we found out he was his own guy, suddenly we found out he was actually Hitler.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Over and over. Yeah. And that's why this reflex to, as we would say in grad school, well, not me, I would never say this, but to other the Houthi into the latest enemies, just wrong and disastrous in a long line of disasters that never led to any good conclusions. So the Egyptians in this glorious era, as it seemed to a lot of people in Egypt, early Nasser era, were full of an intense energy to change the whole region. And a lot of this was prevalent in the Egyptian officer corps. So the Egyptian army did move into Yemen very aggressively. Quote, first came a company of Egyptian commandos to guard the capital, Sana'a, then a squadron of fighters to provide them with air support, and soon after, an armored battalion to secure the surrounding countryside. Yet no force seemed sufficient to secure the Republic, that is the socialist south of Yemen, let alone crush the rebel cause, that is the rebels who were what was to become the Houthi, the north. Over the course of 1963 and 1964, the fighting spread across northern Yemen, sucking in even more Egyptian manpower. The Egyptian army was a pretty formidable force in that era, but it failed, and it failed against what was a sort of proto-Houthi guerrilla force, royalist Yemeni Zaidi Shia militia. They had no air power, very few anti-aircraft weapons. And back in the early 60s, 1960s, air power was very, very effective. Huge anti-aircraft weapons had to be dragged around. They're very hard to deploy without getting destroyed. So it should have been easy to defeat the guerrillas who flocked to the imam in northern Yemen. It was not. And the contemporary accounts reflected the surprise.
Yeah, this quote you have here. From a journalist at the time reporting on it, the incredible fact is the Egyptians are losing in Yemen. Ragged, I mean, echoes here, right? Yeah. Ragged, barefoot Yemeni tribesmen armed only with ancient rifles and faith in Allah are kicking hell out of Nasser's elite troops despite their overpowering Soviet equipment, overwhelmingly superior firepower, and unchallenged air power. Thank God we learned, right? I mean,
I don't think this has ever been mentioned again. It's like, but so the U.S., having decided that Nasser was an evil communist, which was dead wrong, then decided that they would worship the same people who are now the Houthi. Because, I mean, in a way, that illustrates that the rhetoric about Iran in Yemen now is a reversal of what's really happening. The question is whether these people are useful to the West, the U.S. and the U.K., and they are demonized or glorified, depending on whether they are.
Right.
So this is a worshipful account of those people resisting Nasser in, I think, Time magazine or something like that. Quote, "We captured 14 field radios," sighed Prince Abdullah ibn Hassan, a cousin of the Imam, "but none of my men know how to use them. Nor can they use captured tanks or trucks, since none of the tribesmen know how to drive," says Prince Abdullah. "All my men need is bread and bullets. We bow only to God." And this was seen as an extremely admirable take at the time. Everybody in Washington loved them for this, just as they loved the Afghans who were...
I was going to say, man, God, it's like one for one 20 years later, and they clearly learned a lesson here. God, if we can get, you know, if we can weaponize Islam. Well, anyway, we've done episodes on how the empire, the U.S. empire, taking a cue from the U.K. empire, have historically instrumentalized Islamism to fight... Arab nationalism, secular nationalism.
Yeah, and the rest of the story is just pretty grim. This basically was a success mainly thanks to the combat power of the northern Yemeni, or if you like, the proto-Houthi. The Egyptians, in their irritation with these primitives, and they themselves saw the northern Yemenis as primitives, and they got annoyed with them. So they eventually used poison gas on Yemeni villages. And unlike what you see with the total indifference of the Western press to the suffering in Yemen in the last decade, when it was the kind of suffering that you could instrumentalize to do an anti-communist perspective, the Western press was very brave. Here's a quote from the story of a columnist for the Right Wing Telegraph, the same paper that said Southern Yemen was Cuba on the Red Sea. Mm. Quote, "In 1964, Dick Beeston, Telegraph correspondent, scored a notable coup when he traveled for 3 days by lorry, donkey, and on foot to an unmapped village in the Yemeni highlands where the Egyptian Air Force had launched a poison gas attack, the first since Mussolini had bombed Ethiopia 30 years earlier. Among the survivors who pleaded with him for medicines were one woman with bright yellow skin, another blind after rubbing her eyes with contaminated fingers, while a 12-year-old boy had blisters and open wounds the size of half crowns. To ensure the story was not challenged, he carried away the remains of a canister, et cetera, with, you know, Egyptian and eventually Soviet markings on it. As far as I know, Egypt had used gas, not necessarily lethal gas, but certainly an irritant.
Tear gas. This is so interesting. I'll have something to say about this maybe in another episode. That's interesting. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to me, the main thing is, how did he travel into northern Yemen for 3 days when a half century later, no Western reporter seemed to have the guts to do that because nobody was getting paid to do it. Nobody was getting that assignment. Nobody was able to stand out in a career way by doing so. And probably no one would have publicized it if they had.
Yeah. No one wanted to hear it.
Yeah.
The only thing they want to hear is quote unquote proof that the Houthis are proxies of Iran. That's the only thing that matters.
Yeah, and that's just not the story. I mean, people think I'm being soft on socialism or something. I don't get it. But that's just not the way the story reads. Iran is not a player in the history of the Yemeni highlands. Eventually, they drove the Egyptian army, quite a formidable army, out of Yemen, and the part of Yemen that they controlled as their fortress while moving toward the south was exactly the part that is Houthi Yemen today. Exactly. Mm. You can just superimpose the maps on each other. So that is why I don't see that Iran is anything more than a supplier of weapons for the Houthi. It may well be a supplier in a big way for them, although even then, when you try to track down the stories of what Iran has supposedly been importing to the Houthi that is so dangerous, you get some basic surface-to-surface missiles, and even those have been interrupted more recently.
There have also been shipments, alleged shipments of Iranian weapons, probably were, that were intercepted by the Israelis in the past. There have been stories periodically about Iranian weapons to Hamas. I'm sure that the Iranians, very likely that Iranians and Hezbollah have worked with Hamas to help develop their missile technologies and some of their other stuff. But I don't think anybody seriously says Hamas is a proxy of Iran, do they? I mean, except for extreme, hardcore Israelis might say that. I don't know. But I don't think anybody in the West, any respectable person says, oh, Hamas is just a proxy, the way that they throw that around about the Houthis. And again, it's just because we know a lot more because of where our media and where our attention is. We know a lot more about Hamas and Palestinians and so on. And you can even hate Hamas and think that they're evil and so on, but you don't say they're just proxies of Iran. Yeah. It's just not serious. And with the Houthis, it's if anything, even less serious.
It's absurd. Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to say it's absurd. Yeah. There's just not any record of deep Iranian influence over northern Yemen. And in fact, there's not much record of deep foreign influence of any kind. It's a very insular place. That's what stands out in that history. Like, they will fight anybody who gets in their way, and they will occasionally do this quixotic stand, maybe quixotic, maybe heroic, depending on your view, in favor of some other people they see as persecuted, as they have with Gaza. But you're not going to move them. You're not going to change them. They just are what they are.
Yeah. When we did our episodes with Amal Saad on Hezbollah and their relationship, Hezbollah's relationship with Iran, and, we talked about this alleged proxy relationship, and she got into some more of the details of how that relationship works. I mean, that Hezbollah is very independent. The Iranians know this and understand it. That they have, they don't subordinate. they have a much more delicate understanding, respect. I mean, they wouldn't be allies all this time and working with each other if the Iranians yanked them around like little proxies. And it's a really stupid way to try to understand what is going on with that particular group, whether it's Hezbollah and the Shia of Lebanon or Houthis and the Zaydi Shia of Yemen. Just call them proxies. And, think about think about our own idea of proxies. I mean, how many, there aren't, it's kind of hard to actually put your finger on what is a proxy. A proxy is some militant group that is basically on your payroll in the sense that you tell it to jump and they say how high and they do it. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't happen all that often. I think, you know, anti-American, anti-Israel types would might call Israel a proxy of the U.S. And there is a big case to be made. Like, they ran through a lot of their artillery and bombs in the first, like, 5 days of you know, their war. Like, several times the U.S. has come to their aid because they ran out of weapons and ammo. So, you know, Israel would be hugely impacted if the U.S. decided to cut everything off tomorrow. And the same with Ukraine. But I wouldn't call them proxies. I mean, you see Netanyahu yanking around the U.S. You know, Ukraine, if we cut off Ukraine tomorrow, Ukraine might lose. They would still fight. They might lose, but the fight would go on in other ways. Mm-hmm. Now, for the U.S., the Ukrainians, you could say the Ukrainian military, Ukrainians are a proxy for us to take out a, you know, a regional adversary, but that doesn't mean they are a proxy army or a proxy military or a proxy government. It's just that the war is serving a proxy purpose for us.
Yeah, it's strange to think of proxy as having a pejorative connotation right now, because when I think of somebody who really would fit the definition of a proxy in the way that it's used in contemporary rhetoric, it would be members of various communist parties acting as proxies for the Soviet government in the early part, only in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, there were very, very few people who were willing to risk death on orders from Moscow because of solidarity. After 1950 or so, I can't really think of many people.
Yeah, it's, so I think what we have to ask is what does it serve by calling them proxies, the Houthis proxies? Well, it tells people in the home countries, you're actually fighting Iran.
Yeah.
And that feels better than fighting among the poorest people in the world who we just got finished, you know, exterminating hundreds of thousands of them 5 years ago, 3 years ago.
And then briefly decided to send them a whole bunch of food and medicine until we got distracted again.
Yeah. And, you know, Biden has just put them back on, they've redesignated them as terrorists. There's, I think, two designations that really matter in terms of aid. And so they've put them on one designation as terrorists again. And it means doing any business with them or business with people who do business with them can run you into real trouble. So basically it's going to impact food and medicines again. And of course they announced it saying they have one of the largest ever humanitarian carve-outs ever, which that's where the Americans are smarter than the Israelis. The Americans pretend, and the British pretend that we are always being really humanitarian whenever we're killing people. And that way you have that alibi. And the Israelis just dance around and laugh and say, we're exterminating all of them. What can you do? You know, because the Israelis are meatheads. And that's just how it is. But, you know.
I think, it's really, the more you know about Yemen, the harder it is to argue this proxy thing. It just does not track. Doesn't work.
Yeah, and I would recommend, anyway, going back, post some links to some of John's articles over the years on Yemen, and maybe I should post a few links to some episodes. I mean, I think as you wrote way back in the first early Warnerd column for The Exile, I think you were even writing back then, just if anybody, there's so many great stories that have come out of there in wars and empire. I mean, amazing.
Yeah, looking
scores.
Back through it, I really like the story of the Yemeni I met in Najran. I was waiting for my wife to get off work because, you know, you have to stand well back of the girls' school, like behind the concrete barriers and not even look at anybody. So I was doing that. And meanwhile, somebody comes up next to me. You really develop your side vision in that world. And it's this guy who's kind of dirty and kind of scruffy and yet oddly proud. And he says to me with no preamble, "My friend, 9 years ago I come from Yemen. And so, and he sounds very world weary and tired. And so, you give me 10 rial.
And, good for him.
Yeah, I gave him 20. I thought that
you win.
That's like concise as Hemingway.
Yes, yes. Without any conjunction, any ands or anything. Yeah, good for him. That's great. All right, good. On that cheerful note, I think we can end this episode. Yeah,
okay.
On Yemen. And thank you again to everybody, John. And
thanks,
you know,
everybody.
Talk to you next week. I'm sure there'll be more countries bombed, more shit shown by next week. Anyway, talk to you soon.
Yeah, bye. Bye-bye.